History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Although he's largely forgotten outside of Russia, Boris Savinkov was famous and notorious both at home and abroad during his lifetime, which spanned the end of the Russian Empire in the early 20th century and the establishment of the Soviet Union. He was a really complicated individual. He was a moral revolutionary terrorist, sounds like a character out of a Dostoevsky novel, a scandalous novelist, a friend of famous artists, a government minister, a fighter against Lenin and the Bolsheviks, and an advisor to Churchill. At the end of his life, Savinkov conspired to be captured by the Soviet secret police. He was being entrapped, and he knew it, and as the country's most prized political prisoner, made headlines around the world when he claimed that he accepted the Bolshevik state. But some people believe that this was his final gambit, trying to stake his life on a secret plan to strike one last blow against the regime and bring about a better future for Russia. Today's guest is Vladimir Alexandrov. He's a professor of Slavic languages and literature, and author of the new book To Break Russia's Chains, Boris Savinkov and His Wars Against the Tsar and the Bolsheviks. He lived a life that challenges many myths about the Russian Revolution, which was arguably the most important catalyst of 20th century world history. What he tried to do was transform Russia into a uniquely democratic, humane, and enlightened state. Now, he tried to accomplish some of these things by violent means, but the support that he received from many of his countrymen suggests that the paths Russia took forward during the 20th and 21st centuries, the tyranny of communism, the authoritarianism, and the Putin regime, weren't the only destinies of Russia. So his goals are a reminder of how things in Russia could have turned out very differently, and maybe they still could someday. This is a really interesting discussion about what could have been in Russia, what it takes for a revolution not to go terribly wrong and lead to authoritarianism, and many other things. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Vladimir Alexandrov. Vladimir, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Scott. Glad to be here.
Well, your book looks at a very fascinating character, but the setting is Imperial Russia. And I've read enough 19th century Russian literature to know some of the tropes. And for those who are really into it, Imperial Russia is so fascinating because the impression, at least from different works of literature, is that you have larger than life characters who are debating grand existential life issues. But others who've studied Imperial Russia, maybe they feel a sense of melancholy that the empire was on a trajectory of reform. It abolished serfdom. It was modernizing. And some had a hope that perhaps, like Imperial Japan, it could produce the fruits of Western European technology and civil society, yet maintain its own distinct culture. But then the Russian Revolution happens and the Cold War, etc. So for you as a professor of Slavic languages and literature, how fair do you think it is, this characterization of Imperial Russia? It was grand, and there's much of what could have been but didn't happen. So how fair do you think this is?
I think actually that's very, very accurate. My protagonist, my hero in this biography, fits part of that scenario very well, Boris Savinkov. You mentioned great works of Russian literature and philosophizing characters. Savinkov could have come out of a novel by Dostoevsky. He was very important as a writer for Savinkov. He read his works, he echoed them in his own works. But in addition to the kind of melancholia regarding the fact that the empire had potential that could have developed peacefully, there was another streak in late Imperial Russian history, as you know, and that was rebellion. For these rebels of different political stripes, the changes that were happening in Russia, which were real, were still too little too late. They were impatient. They didn't believe that the changes could really radically change the empire. And that's what spawned, beginning in the 19th century, revolutionaries. And Savinkov was one of them. So he fits, to some extent, part of what you described, but he also adds another element to it. He became one of the most prominent revolutionaries of his generation.
To get into more detail about what's happening in Imperial Russia, for those who are non-specialists, could you set the stage and share any salient facts. When Savinkov is opposing elements of Russian imperial society, he believes that reform isn't radical enough. To ask a very broad question, what is happening in Imperial Russia at the time to give context to his life?
It was a place in which there were contradictory tendencies. You mentioned at the outset accurately that there was a process of modernization going on. It began around 1880 with Alexander II. Then there was a period of stagnation. By the beginning of the 20th century, the imperial economy was improving. There was agitation from various elements of Russian society to liberalize the empire. But as I mentioned, the regime wasn't moving quickly enough. So Savinkov and his fellows began to agitate for reform and change through a very violent method. They became terrorists. They believed that by using targeted assassinations of leading figures in the Russian imperial regime, and only the leading figures, they were very concerned about accidentally harming innocent bystanders. They thought that they could rock the foundation of the Russian Empire and move it more rapidly toward reform, which is actually what happened. Savinkov was involved in two spectacular terrorist assassinations, one in 1904, when his team killed the Minister of the Interior, a man who was reviled by many elements in Russian liberal society for, among other things, being a rabid anti-Semite. And then in 1905, in an even more spectacular assassination, Savinkov's team, and I keep saying team because he actually never killed anybody himself, he coordinated it, killed in the middle of the Kremlin, the Tsar's uncle, Grand Duke Sergei, who was also a reactionary pillar of the Russian imperial regime. And as a result of this, the imperial regime felt compelled to start introducing reforms. The biggest of them was the one that came after the assassination of the Grand Duke in the Kremlin, in the so-called October Manifesto of 1905, which was the introduction by Tsar Nicholas II of a proto-parliament, an elected body, the first time in modern Russian history. So the kinds of methods that Savinkov and his ilk, members of his party, advocated seem to be working and forcing the regime through this kind of surgical terrorism that they practiced to start liberalizing more and more. Then it was a process of up and down. You know, the regime seemed to liberalize, then it would retract some of its liberalizations, the revolutionaries would agitate for more. And where all of that would have gone is pretty much anyone's guess, because the wild card that came was, of course, the Great War that started in 1914, that changed everybody's map for everything.
And one other question before getting into Savinkov's life specifically, do you have a sense of what sort of revolution he and his ilk were looking at as examples? Because there are a lot happening in Europe at this time. I mean, some are fantastically successful, at least from the Ottoman Empire side. There are many states in Eastern Europe that are breaking away successfully. Many, like Bulgaria, they trigger a fight with the Ottomans because they want to be attacked. They don't hope to win, but if you can bring in Russia, the Ottomans, which don't want a war, it could lead to a process which could give them independence, which did happen to Bulgaria. And then conversely, on the Armenian side, other revolutionaries were trying to engage a similar process, which, to not oversimplify, a very complex turn of events led to the Armenian genocide of 1915. But within the Ottoman Empire itself, they had the Young Turk Revolution, which briefly led to the reestablishment of a parliament, but then it led to a military triumvirate that was not that. So do you have a sense of what these revolutionaries, what sort of model they were looking at as they were engaging in these activities?
Yeah, Savinkov's party, the Socialist Revolutionaries, had a very specific and well-worked out program. Maybe the first thing to say about them, because it's the most important, is that they were not Marxists. They did not believe in class warfare. In fact, the Bolsheviks and the other Marxist parties and Savinkov's party hated each other because they were ideological enemies. So what did Savinkov's party want? It wanted a free democratic republic with the socialization of the land and of the industrial sector In other words, the land had to be given to the peasants, and control over the factories had to be given to the workers in them. There were no class distinctions as far as the socialist revolutionaries were concerned that were as coercive as the ones the Bolsheviks conceived of. In other words, the Bolsheviks thought that if you came from a rich bourgeois family, you were marked by that for life. And the only thing that could be done with you is to suppress you. And they did that when they took power. They killed lots of people simply for having been well off before the revolution. The socialist revolutionaries were open to anyone, as long as the people, whether they were nobles, peasants, workers, middle class, it didn't make any difference, signed on to the idea of establishing a government where the people decided both the political life of the country and its economic direction. Another element that's important to mention, because we know what happened in 1917 and after when the Bolsheviks took over, the Bolsheviks tried to export their revolution, and they eventually did much later in the 20th century. They took over Eastern Europe. A cardinal feature of Savinkov's party was the belief in the national self-determination of all peoples who had been parts of the Russian Empire. In other words, Finland for the Finns, Poland for the Poles, Ukraine for the Ukrainians, and so on and so forth. They were not interested in the kind of neo-imperialism that the Marxist-inspired Bolsheviks practiced. So the differences between them were vast.
All right, well, this is opening up all sorts of what-if possibilities of how the 20th century would have played out and World War II, everything else. But before going down that rabbit trail, I figure we have to get into Savinkov's life, and exploring these different three themes through a biography is a great method, which you employed, especially through such a intriguing figure. So tell me about his life. I mean, you have so many interesting characteristics that you say, scandalous novelist, moral revolutionary terrorist, friend of epoch-defining artist, friend of Winston Churchill, or advisor to Winston Churchill. So yeah, set the stage. Tell me about his life.
You know, if we had 17 hours, it could do it justice. But in a nutshell, I can just say what it is that brought me to him. It's the fact that he led an incredibly adventurous life, that if you read about it in a novel that was a thriller, labeled as a thriller, you'd say, well, you know, it's entertaining, but it's invention. He came from a comfortable background, raised in a very liberal atmosphere. And because of the heavy-handed policies of the Russian imperial regime when he was a student in the University of St. Petersburg, protesting relatively minor things, he was arrested and put in prison. And of course, that radicalized him. So he decided, we have to change the system. Student concerns are no longer sufficient for my focus. So he joined what was then the most popular of the radical Russian parties that wanted change immediately, the socialist revolutionaries. He was also a romantic figure. He liked the idea of going against the regime with a small team of like-minded individuals. So he joined the combat organization, as it was known, of the Socialist Revolutionary Party. This was the terrorist branch that carried out these amazing surgical strikes. Let me just tell you one sort of anecdote about how these people operated. In 1905, Savinkov's team targeted the Grand Duke that I mentioned, Sergei. And the man who was actually supposed to throw the bomb at Sergei's carriage as it was driving through central Moscow ran up to it in the middle of the night and then stopped because he was able to see inside that next to the Grand Duke were his wife and their two adopted children. In other words, he felt it would be morally indefensible to harm the innocent family members of the Grand Duke's family. And when he went to Savinkov, and this is where the Dostoevskian character issue comes up, Savinkov is waiting in a garden that's along the edge of the Kremlin to see what would happen. So the fellow who just stopped the attempt he was going to carry out came to Savinkov, and in the middle of the night, in a freezing Moscow winter, they start discussing whether it's moral or immoral to, in fact, assassinate innocents. And Savinkov says, no, you were right. It would have been immoral. We cannot do this. So that was one phase of his life when he worked as the leader of this terrorist branch. I should mention that his efforts were undermined by a notorious double agent who was actually the head of the combat organization. You mentioned at the very outset that Russian imperial history is filled with lurid, larger-than-life figures. People frequently think of Rasputin, for example. Well, the one I'm thinking of, whose name last name was Azef, rivals Rasputin in terms of the effect he had on the course of Russian history and on people who were players in it. At any rate, the revolutionary movement petered out for various reasons. Savinkov lived in exile in Europe, where he became a prominent writer. His first novel, which was a thinly veiled story of his exploits as a terrorist, caused an international sensation. Eventually, everybody read it. When Savinkov met Churchill years later, Churchill had read the novel, which is one of the reasons why he became interested in Savinkov. Then everything changed for Savinkov when the Great War began. He was an ardent opponent of German militarism, and he feared that if Russia lost the war to the Central Powers, that the Germans would impose a system on Russia worse than the one that existed under the emperors. So he became a war correspondent on the Western Front and wrote patriotic pieces extolling the French and Belgian soldiers and trying to rally the people back home in Russia to continue to support the war. Well, we know what happened. In 1917, there was the first revolution in February, or March, according to the Western calendar. And that's what marked the turning point in Savinkov's life, because he rushed home. He was now able to return to Russia because there was a new regime in power, and became a member of the government. So to go from being a terrorist skulking around at night near the Kremlin to becoming a member of the government of revolutionary Russia was quite a trajectory. There's more along these lines, but maybe we should pause.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Could you give me a sense of, I don't know if there's an analogy we can make in the United States that, for example, I don't know, somebody in the 1930s Hollywood who maybe leaves the United States during the Red Scare because of communist sympathies, but then if there were a complete party reversal, comes back and is an active member of the government, how is he received back in Russia? Because at this time, he's an international novelist who talks about his terrorist exploits. So what does this look like when he returns?
Well, but he's also somebody with terrific revolutionary credentials, because his name was a household name among the liberal left revolutionary strata of Russian society, which were now in the ascendant, because the revolution of February, March, 1917 put into power people who were liberal and left-wing. The right-wing was sort of out of it for the time being. And so Savinkov was embraced. He was given a prominent position immediately as what was called a commissar to the army. His job was to represent the provisional government in St. Petersburg for an entire large section of the front where the Russians were fighting the Austro-Hungarians and the Germans. And his job was to agitate for victory. He was trying to instill a desire to win in the Russian troops. The Russians had a mixed record during the Great War. And by the time Savinkov got to Russia in 1917, morale in the Russian armies was plummeting, and he was supposed to do whatever he could to keep it up. And he did such a good job in trying to keep the entire armies that were under his jurisdiction motivated, that when in July of 1917, there was a change in the government in St. Petersburg, the new prime minister said, "We have to have you in the government. Your being on the front agitating for victory just isn't enough." And that's when Savinkov was made the vice minister for war of the Russian provisional government, where he continued to try to push his agenda of the Russian armies have to win the war that they began fighting on the side of the Allies.
Well, there's a lot of different parties and factions that are competing for power in the course of the Russian Revolution. And tell me how he navigates all of this. What happens with his career? How does he fall out of favor?
Well, his experience at the front showed him the kind of negative influence on the course of the war that the Marxist Bolsheviks were having. when the Great War began, different radical parties took different views of it. As I said, Savinkov's people, for the most part, said, we have to forget about our revolutionary goals. We have to support our country against the Germans. The Marxists saw things differently. They thought that the Great War had nothing to do with the interests of the working class or the peasantry, and therefore they were opposed to its continuation. The Marxist Bolsheviks saw the Great War as being a war between the capitalist bourgeois leaders of the leading countries. So the Bolsheviks were agitating in the opposite direction from what Savinkov was doing when he was a commissar at the front. He kept exhorting the troops to fight on. The Bolsheviks were trying to get the troops to lay down their arms, to fraternize with the enemy, to desert, and to agitate for stopping the war. So Savinkov had a very clear sense of who his primary ideological enemies were. He also saw a powerful authoritarian streak in the Bolsheviks, because Lenin, the leader of the Bolsheviks, wanted there to be top-down control of the revolutionary movement. Savinkov believed in something that went from the ground up, another difference between him and his enemies. So when he got into the position of power in revolutionary Petrograd, as the city became known at the time, St. Petersburg's name was changed, he made it his task not only to try to continue to fight the war with the Allies against the Central Powers, but also whatever he could to limit the Bolsheviks' influence. And he tried to advocate for serious measures. In July of 1917, Lenin made his first attempt to seize power. He wasn't interested in using democratic processes to do this. He thought he could do it by force. That failed. Savinkov agitated for the arrest of the leading Bolsheviks and for putting them on trial. He also wanted to publicize the fact that Lenin and his followers, as everybody now knows, were brought to Russia by the Germans in a sealed train and given a lot of money to help foment a radical revolution. In other words, Savinkov detested the idea that the Germans were trying to meddle in the development of the Russian Revolution. So he did two things. He kept trying to limit the power of the Bolsheviks. He tried to steer the liberal members of the government who sympathized with the Bolsheviks away from doing so. And he kept exhorting the Russian armies to continue to fight until total victory. So the Bolsheviks saw him as an enemy very early on.
Now, what eventually happens to him is very interesting, and I want to hear at length your theory on how you think final events with Savinkov play out. But I want to pause here and ask a question about revolutions. It sounds like there's a good reason to believe that had Savinkov been successful, that his revolution would have been much better. It would have been more democratic, more humane, following the path of national self-determination, so there wouldn't have been the same deleterious influence on other nations. But I wonder, how do you do a revolution the right way? Because in one sense, the gravity of a revolution, by its very nature, is a radical event. You are overthrowing a pre-existent order, no matter how corrupt that order is. So it seemed the gravity would always be pulled toward the most radical elements, that the Bolsheviks would be the people. In the American Revolutionary sense, you had plenty of firebrand figures who were much more radical than what became the cohort of the founding fathers. And the American Revolution could have easily gone, depending on some opinion, the French Revolutionary route. And you could have gone in the Robespierre direction of completely beheading all royalists or former sympathizers with them. So how do you thread this needle and have a revolution the right way that doesn't follow to the most radical extreme elements?
Now, you're right to raise this as an issue because it directly concerns Savinkov. You know, the continuation of the French Revolution after the Terror was Napoleon. It was the reconstitution of a monarchical system, with changes, obviously, in comparison to the old regime. But what did the revolution achieve except to put a new person on the throne? The potential for that was present in Russia as well and in connection with Savinkov, because the chaos that the revolution spawned, massive desertions of troops from the front, a constant agitation by workers in the rear, jockeying for position by various parties, some more radical, some less radical. The country was falling apart. The institutions of social order were seriously weakened. Chaos kept growing. The center wasn't holding. So how do you solve this problem to be able to do anything constructive? Savinkov fell under the lure or the temptation of Napoleon, let's put it succinctly. He began to think that the only way to get out of the mess that Russia was in was to have centralized power in the hands of a small number of well-minded men. And this was a step in the direction of something like maybe not a single Napoleonic figure, but a triumvirate. In fact, Savinkov at one point in August of 1917 came up with a plan that almost worked, where the entire government would have been run by Alexander Kerensky, who was the left-wing liberal prime minister of the country, General Lavr Kornilov, who was a military hero of the Russian army, a very democratically inclined fellow, came from a very humble background himself, and was committed to a democratic republic for the future of Russia, and Savinkov as the third person in all of this. So the idea was that the three of them, because they're well-intentioned, would take over everything and try to run things in such a way that it would be for the greater good of all. But of course, the temptation when you've narrowed the playing field from countless teams pulling in different directions to three people is to perhaps think that maybe even the best solution would be to have just one person in charge of everything. So there is no question that Savinkov was aware of this as a potential. And later on, when he became interested in Mussolini, as so many Europeans, and for that matter, Americans did in the early 1920s, it shows that the appeal of dictatorship was one that he was well aware of himself. So right. What would have happened? It's possible, and this was the plan, that this triumvirate that Savinkov dreamt up was going to hold power until the Constituent Assembly could meet and elect a new government. They all said that's what they wanted. In other words, there was a mass election in Russia in 1917. Delegates were supposed to gather and elect and form a new government. That actually was supposed to happen at the beginning of 1918. And the idea of this authoritarian triumvirate was to get the country to that point. And once there was a constituent assembly, they could decide whatever they wanted. It could have played out that way. And it would have played out that way if Lenin hadn't scattered at gunpoint the constituent assembly when it did meet in January of 1918.
Well, I'll put a pin on the what if, because we don't know what could have happened. I mean, maybe Russia could have evolved along the fascist lines of 1920s, 1930s, Italy, Germany. I mean, maybe it could have followed a natural evolution of more democratic institutions. But before getting into all that, and I'm sure you've played out many of these scenarios or speculated, what happens when that doesn't happen, when these delegates are scattered and Savinkov falls out of power?
Savinkov has to run for his life because he's on a short list of people who the Bolsheviks saw as their enemies, and they would have arrested him. And especially in those early chaotic months, judgment was summary. People who were deemed to be enemies were simply shot without any kind of an attempt to conduct a reasonable trial. But Savinkov, one of Savinkov's most important traits, and one of the ones that brought me to him, was that he was indefatigable. He would not give up. He tried to organize resistance to the Bolsheviks when they seized power in October, November of 1917. When that didn't succeed, he went to where there was a movement being organized in the south of Russia, in the Don Cossack lands, to form an army against the Bolsheviks. This was the White Army that was being formed, led by former generals that he knew from the time that he was the vice minister of war. He tried to find a place for himself in their movement, but they were, to some considerable extent, still monarchist. They reviled him for his revolutionary past. And they got rid of him by sending him on a mission to Moscow. They wouldn't give him a place in their ranks. And so then Savinkov, seeing what was going on, decided he was not going to give up. He wasn't going to be shunted aside. And he organized his own movement against the Bolsheviks in the summer and spring of 1918. He was planning to try to seize power in Moscow with his own people. And by this point, his people were a really mixed bag, which is an interesting form of evidence regarding how committed he was to pluralism in politics, because he had been a socialist revolutionary, but he accepted into his ranks anybody who stood for the Constituent Assembly, in other words, gathering the people to decide the kind of government that they want, for basic democratic freedoms, and for resistance to the Bolsheviks. Anyway, he organized an army that was supposed to seize power. That itself went through a whole series of permutations and conflicts and problems. It did not succeed. He was hoping the French would invade Russia and help him defeat the Bolsheviks. As you know, the Allies and other countries were nibbling on the edges of the Russian former empire. There were lots of troops in the south on the Siberian coast and in the north. And Savinkov was hoping that with the assistance of the Allies, the Bolsheviks could be overthrown. But it didn't happen. Well, that didn't stop him either, though.
And for listeners who want some more context, I did a very long 20-part series with a co-host called Key Battles of World War One. And Russia mostly drops out of the narrative after the revolution because it's a military history. But to understand what's continues with Russia, this is a great companion episode. And then also the member of the triumvirate you mentioned as a general, we explain why he was at least so beloved at this time. So the final stage on his life when he renounces his earlier claims, could you describe that? How was that received in the international community? And I would love to hear what you think he was really planning.
Savinkov was looking to get help from anybody who would listen to overthrow the Bolsheviks. As I mentioned, he tried doing it himself with an army that he raised. Incidentally, there were all kinds of turning points in early Bolshevik history. In July 1918, and I'll describe why this is relevant to Savinkov, a faction of the socialist revolutionaries, who, as I mentioned originally, were at odds with the Bolshevik Marxists, organized a rebellion in Moscow. They came extremely close to seizing power, because the Bolshevik regime was very weak. It was a matter of several thousand troops, and the country's leadership could have been arrested and a completely different regime could have been installed. That was exactly what Savinkov had been planning to do originally before he was sidetracked by the French promise of an invasion from the north. But anyway, when that failed, Savinkov allied himself with an anti-Bolshevik movement in Siberia, which did very well for a while, but then was pushed back. He then went to Paris, and he arrived in Paris just when the armistice was signed in November of 1918, and tried to get involved in the peace conference that was happening to represent what he thought were Russia's real interests. And that, in his view, involved agitating the Allies to turn their bayonets, as it were, from the Central Powers to the Bolsheviks, who were the new enemy. And the reaction to this was mixed. You mentioned Churchill before. Winston Churchill embraced Savinkov completely. The kinds of documents that Churchill wrote for distribution to the British cabinet after he met with Savinkov could have been written by Savinkov himself. They were such a perfect match for each other. And Churchill helped the anti-Bolshevik movement that was still fighting in Russia a great deal, with materiel and money. But there were others, both in the British government and in France and in the United States, who didn't want to get involved in the Russian Civil War, which was raging at that time. Savinkov did everything he could to try to persuade the Allies to continue the fight against the Bolsheviks, but they, in the end, refused. So what was he left with? No Allies were going to be coming to fight the Bolsheviks. He again tried to organized rebellions among the peasants in Russia on his own. And then I mean, it sounds like I'm making these things up. He had been friends for a considerable time before this with a man who became the leader of a newly independent Poland. Now, Poland had not existed since the 18th century as a separate country because Poland had been partitioned by Russia, Austria, and Prussia. In 1918, Poland pronounced its independence with the collapse of the Russian Empire. And the leader of the new Poland was an old revolutionary terrorist who was friends with Savinko. And he invited him to Poland to organize a private army to help the Poles fight the Bolsheviks, which Savinko proceeded to do. So he didn't give up. When that failed, he decided he would try to disrupt the rapprochement that was going on between the Bolsheviks and the Western powers. He did this in part with Churchill's help, and he did it on his own. In 1922, he went to Genoa in Italy, where there was a major international conference that was supposed to bring the new Bolshevik state into the brotherhood of countries in Europe. Savinko wanted to stop that by assassinating a leading Soviet delegate. That also didn't work. By this point, his story changes dramatically because he has been a thorn in the Soviet side for a long time, for over 4 years. And they decide they have to put a stop to him. And that initiates another phase in his life entirely.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Is this when he conspires his own capture?
Yeah. It begins, I mean, the Soviets are very good at this kind of stuff. They would try to provoke somebody that they wanted to capture by dangling something in front of them. And when the victim took the bait, they would gobble him up. So the thing with Savinko that they invented for his benefit was that here you are living in the West, this, you know, famous anti-Bolshevik leader. They leaked to him the idea in a very cunning way that there was actually an underground movement in Soviet Russia that wanted to overthrow the Bolsheviks. And it was looking for a new leader, and they wanted Savinko to become their leader. Now, he knew that the Soviet secret police were a devious organization, but the possibility of exploiting this situation appealed to him enormously. This is where history becomes debatable, and there are different takes on what happened here. My view is that Savinko tried to take advantage of what he suspected was a trap. He thought that if he allowed himself to be taken by the Soviets, that over time he would be able to ingratiate himself with them sufficiently to be released. And then he would be able to carry out his own secret plan. Let's not say what the secret plan is to keep any listeners who are interested. So, as I said, you know, this could be read different ways. I provide what I think is pretty compelling evidence in my book for why I think Savinko was playing a very duplicitous game against a very dangerous enemy when he returned to Soviet Russia in 1924.
Right. So that is a great setup, something to tantalize listeners. But also, I'll be interested to see your process of trying to reconstruct these events, since the secret police would tend not to keep neatly filed records that could be found in an archive for anyone to go into and just grab at will. So it takes some forensic work to try to put this back together.
And in fact, you know, the archive or the archival holdings about Savinko are vast, and they have hardly been tapped so far. And the most interesting documents are in the FSB, the formerly KGB archives in Moscow, which are no longer open to researchers. They were briefly after the Soviet Union collapsed, and some very interesting stuff about Savinko was culled from them and published by historians. But there are several scores of volumes of documents about him that are known to be there, and it's anyone's guess when or if they'll ever be made available to researchers.
Why do you think he hasn't been as either well-studied as other figures? Setting aside the issue of the lack of access to archives, Is it because he doesn't fall into one of the neatly defined ideological camps? And outside of specialists, your casual historian of the 20th century wouldn't really know where to put these figures who fall in the cracks?
Yes, I think that that has a lot to do with it. Let me just tell you a brief anecdote. A few years ago when I was in St. Petersburg, I went to the Museum of Russian Political History. Very interesting place. Lots of exhibits pertaining to the various factions that were involved in the revolutionary turmoil, you know, of the period around 1917. I looked at it very thoroughly, and I couldn't find anything in it about Savinkov. He wasn't mentioned even once. So I asked to speak to a curator. They will do that for you. And I asked him, you know, what's going on? Obviously, Savinkov was a player. He was a member of the government. He said, it's what the Soviet historiographers did. They wrote him out of history, because the Soviet view of the revolution was that there was the empire, then there was this failed bourgeois fake revolution, and then there was our triumphant revolution that set up a new order. They had defeated Savinkov. He wasn't a player in their view, and I guess maybe they didn't want to, what, inflate his importance by giving him the kind of attention that his actual historical role warranted. It's interesting that now that access to many, but not all archives has been improved, some professional Russian historians are beginning to reevaluate Savinkov. They are writing archivally based monographs about him and presenting him not just as a fascinating character with an adventurous life, but as an historically important one. That's part of the answer to what you were asking about. I also want to mention something else. Despite the kind of official attempt to suppress information about Savinkov or to sweep him under the historical rug during the Soviet period, he continued to live in the popular imagination. There were novels written about him, or there were characters in novels based on him during the Soviet period. There were films and TV series made about him simply because he was such a colorful figure. In Soviet Russia, in contrast to the West, and in post-Soviet Russia, in contrast to the West, Savinkov was in some regards a legendary figure. Even if it was during the Soviet period, in the popular imagination, he was an indefatigable fighter. And the significance of his defeat is that look what we Bolsheviks managed to overcome in an opponent as committed as Savinkov was. So one way or the other, because of a kind of a grudging respect for him, or because of seeing him as being evil embodied, he continued to exist in the popular imagination. And now, if you enter in Russian Boris Savinkov revolutionary into the Russian search engine Yandex, you'll get millions of hits. There are thousands of people who keep posting stuff about him, you know, with varying degrees of sympathy or antipathy, and with very varying degrees of actual understanding of what he was about. But he is literally a legendary figure in Russia, and he's just not known in the West. You know, maybe my book will change that a bit.
Well, that's really interesting that he becomes mythologized both by people who support him and oppose him. I mean, it sounds like the stories that surround the rise of Islam and how Byzantine Emperor Heraclius is mythologized as a great opponent of Islam because the Byzantines weren't able to be conquered by them. Or Saladin in the Crusader mythologies that, again, he defeated Richard the Lionheart. So if you're trying to create a glorious narrative, then you want to have a very worthy opponent. Now, he was defeated, I suppose you could say, but still, the fact that he would live on like that, that's very interesting. So I want to get to the, I think, one of the main points of your book and something we've alluded to in our discussion, and that's you say that the support he receives from his countrymen suggests that the paths Russia took during the 20th and 21st centuries, communism, the authoritarianism of Putin's regime, weren't the only ones written in Russia's historical destiny. So what could have happened if he was successful? And what do you hope will be the points that readers take away from learning about his story?
Yeah, Important issues, all of them. Let me just mention here that his potential significance in Russian history was recognized by foreigners during his life. During the turmoil of the Russian Revolutionary period, the French ambassador to Russia, the British ambassador to Russia, W. Somerset Maugham, the famous English writer and playwright, who had been sent to Russia as a spy, they all wrote in different ways about Savinkov's significance for Russia. Somerset Maugham even remembered, as did Churchill, that this was one of the most memorable individuals he ever met in his life, and had his views triumphed, Lenin would have been forgotten. And Savinkov's point of view and Savinkov's agenda would have been in place. So the Bolsheviks were committed to tyranny, as their entire history showed. Their best known opponents, best known in the West, the whites, were for the most part inclined toward restoring the monarchy, or certainly restoring some kind of a bourgeois upper class form of government. They lost in part because they couldn't gain the support of the people, the peasants in particular. And we have to remember that Russia at the time had a population that was 80% peasant. So Savinkov offered a different model. He, as I said, wanted a democratic republic based on socialist principles, giving the land to the people who worked it. Had he succeeded, and it could have happened at the various turning points that I referred to, and had he managed to avoid the temptation of the Napoleonic model, which he was tempted by, so it can't be written off entirely. It was not a guarantee that somebody with his mentality would simply have yielded power. But let's give him the benefit of the doubt. I mean, he put his life on the line for his principles for decades. So let's assume he meant what he was saying. Then Russia might have emerged in a completely different way, and the consequences for world history would have been incalculably different. People think, you know, well, there was the Russian Empire, that was a tyranny. There were the whites, there were monarchists, the Bolsheviks, we know about what kind of regime they set up. Putin is continuing in the same strand of authoritarianism. Savinkov represented a different way. And he put his life on the line repeatedly to try to achieve it, despite these caveats regarding his interest in Napoleonic figures. So it's important to understand, I think, that it's not in Russia's genetic code to always choose the authoritarian path. This is actually a point that has come up in recent years by people who should know better when talking about the meddling of the Russians in the 2016 election and things around that. Now, some people have said, you know, this is the way Russians are. Well, Savinkov shows a different possibility, one that came close to being realized in fact, not just on paper. And it's worth remembering that. And maybe the example that he said, and I'm not advocating assassinations as a political method here, but the commitment to his ideals that he had, maybe they'll be realized someday. Maybe it shows that Russia can join the Brotherhood of Nations the way Savinkov wanted it to be way back over a century ago.
Well, that shows that the continued popular interest in him shows that this is a strain that isn't marginal, but something that is present, and no reason to suspect it couldn't emerge later. Well, thank you so much for sharing this story. I mean, these are exactly the types of people I love to learn about that are highly influential and important at their time, but due to reasons of history or the long radioactive half-life of historical narratives that can push out figures like this because they don't fit into easily identifiable camps, are people that I love to rediscover. So thank you very much for sharing this. And for listeners who want to read more, the name of the book is To Break Russia's Chains, Boris Savinkov and His Wars Against the Tsar and the Bolsheviks. Vladimir, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Scott. It was a pleasure.
All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Harrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.